A History of Science was presented by Chris Swanson on August 7, 2006 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Chris has been involved in Gutenberg since before it was Gutenberg. He was one of the, there were four of us that started planning Gutenberg before it happened. Chris was, he got his PhD in physics at the University of Oregon, and then you had already received your doctorate when we started planning Gutenberg, hadn't you, or were you just finishing up? So then he stayed on at the University of Oregon doing research in low temperature physics. For a number of years and taught at Gutenberg since the beginning. So he's been teaching here for about 12 years. And I think it would be fair to say that as a result of teaching here, we have his horizons have been broadened. And I think that I suspect that there's been some significant change even in his view of science as a result of being here and teaching here. So that, I think, will be the basis for his comments today.
Okay, so I'm going to speak about the history of science. Naturally, fell to me as a physicist to give a lecture like this, but I have a warning. As a scientist, I have experimentally determined a physical law, and that is that physicists in general are rather dry speakers. There have been counterexamples to this law suggested, but I'm skeptical.
Is that just a theory or a law?
This is a physical law that has been empirically determined by my experience at many physics lectures. So just so much for the warning. The reason why we're going to talk about the history of science is because we want to get some grasp of where we are in our culture and why we believe the things that we do believe about science. So I thought maybe we could start by talking about sort of the general framework that we find ourselves in today with regard to our belief about science. Some of the features that we find in our current situation today are that science is first authoritative. Generally speaking, when some scientist says X is true, the culture and at large says, yeah, that's right. The scientist said it must be true. They say that their conclusions are proven, whatever proven means. They say that the conclusions that scientists come to are somehow, or at least I think our culture feels that somehow the knowledge that scientists come to is somehow better or more certain or more true than other kinds of knowledge that we can come to. So that's one of the features that is sort of floating around in our culture, at least it seems to me, with regard to science. A second one is that science is objective, that it is not dependent on our particular whim or desire to believe one way or the other, that the data always tells us exactly what's true, and whether or not we want to believe it, we have to go with the data, so it's objective. Scientists are objective, they're unbiased, they remove themselves out of the picture, and therefore the evidence that we get is objective. That's one of the reasons why science is somewhat authoritative. Another one is that science uses a known method. There's this technique that all scientists, when they go into their labs and they put on their little white coats and stuff like that, they use this technique, and they always come up with answers. The technique is somewhat self-correcting, that if they come up with the wrong answer, that other people will do more experiments and they'll be able to correct the problems that came up in the first place, that the conclusions that they come up with are testable, that sort of thing like that. Another sort of general perspective that people have about science is that science is the study of things which are real, truly physical. That the only things that are real are things which are physical. And this is what we've been talking about as naturalism. I mean, Judge Jones referred to it as methodological naturalism, which says that we're really interested in studying only natural and physical processes. But underlying that is sort of a general naturalism that says that the natural world is all there is out there. Obviously, we as Christians can't believe that. But it is a perspective which is widely held in the scientific community, I think. And then last is in some ways in tension to everything that's been said up to now, and that is that science is always approaching but never reaching the final truth. Okay? You'll often hear something like that, which is in contradiction in some ways with the idea that science is true and authoritative and all those sorts of things like that. And it will be interesting to find out as I go through here, we'll see about where that kind of idea came from. Okay, so if we lay out this view of science that our culture largely holds, I mean, obviously there are lots and lots of different veins in our culture and not everybody holds this particular perspective. But if we do look at this particular perspective, it raises a question or a problem for us as believers, it seems to me. It suggests that we who believe are not basing our knowledge on objective truth or reason or something like that, but because we want it to be true. We believe because we want it to be true. Obviously, I don't take that particular perspective. And our culture encourages us to believe that way, encourages us to accept that framework. I mean, even within churches, sometimes this kind of perspective is suggested, that faith is somehow a different kind of knowledge than science, and that science is somehow a more superior kind of knowledge or a different kind of knowledge than more rational than faith or something like that. So I think it can be intended to take the knowledge of spiritual things about the Bible or things like that and to make that kind of an inferior kind of a knowledge, not as good of a knowledge. So the question then is, where did we get this idea? And that's what I want to talk about for the most of the time. Where did we get this idea of science and how did it come to us in our culture? Probably the place to start would be with the Greeks, but I'm going to skip them and I'm going to go straight to the medieval period. And the reason why is because the medieval period is going to sum up the key features of the Greek ideals that are going to be necessary for us to think about. So let's talk a little bit about the medieval period and what people thought about science in the medieval period. Primarily in the medieval period, I mean, natural science that we think of it didn't even really exist in the way that we think of it in sort of modern times. Knowledge and truth was determined primarily through authorities. Authorities could be texts like the Bible. There were authorities like the Greeks, Aristotle and Plato. And there were authorities like the Church Fathers and their writings, and the Catholic Church and the statements of the Catholic Church and the things that they suggested. So there were a number of different authorities. One of the major thrusts in a lot of medieval scholarship is to make all of the various authorities agree with each other, or to make sense of them, to figure out what's the right way among all these authorities, to interpret them in such a way so that they all fit together. One of the big authorities, especially with regard to science, was Aristotle. And Aristotle had a particular view of knowledge. He said that there were two kinds, at least two kinds, maybe there was more, I don't know. I know at least two kinds of knowledge, that one of them is demonstration, or science, and the other one is opinion. Demonstration is sort of logical reasoning using syllogisms. Syllogism is something like all dogs are animals. my pup Misha is a dog, therefore my pup Misha is an animal. Okay? If you believe the premises, if the premises are true, all dogs are animals, and my pup Misha is a dog, then the conclusion necessarily follows. So science is starting from premises and using logical deduction and syllogisms in order to come to conclusions. The tricky part is the premises. Okay? Where do you start from? Okay? How do you know that the premises that you begin with are the correct premises? And for Aristotle, the first premises were those things which were, I have a quote, true, primary, immediate, better known than, and prior to the conclusion. So he had this belief that we could determine those first premises, that we could look and use our senses experiences, our minds, and that those first premises were going to be obvious and true, and there weren't going to be any problems with coming up with those first premises. Examples of Aristotelian sort of knowledge of science would be Euclidean geometry. I don't know if any of you have had any experience with Euclidean geometry, but basically you lay down postulates and some common notions and some definitions, some first principles, and then you go through and you use these principles to deduce a huge number of widely varying and different conclusions in geometry. So this is sort of like the pinnacle of Aristotelian thought. You start with first premises, they're self-evidently true, and you can derive all kinds of information from that. So that's science. Optics was another science, those sorts of things. Opinion are things which may be true, but aren't necessarily true. So they've not been demonstrated from first principles. You have an opinion when you believe that your particular perspective is true, but the contrary may be true. And since it's not been necessarily demonstrated from first principles, which are obviously true, it's not science. Okay, so this is almost a technical kind of a way of thinking about opinion and science. And that idea, I think, lasted through the medieval period. I think that you'll see it in the Aquinas reading, that his idea of opinion and science and those sorts of things are derived from this Aristotelian perspective. In addition to Aristotelian knowledge, which the Middle Ages adopted, there was also sort of an Aristotelian worldview that came out of that Greek perspective. And the Aristotelian worldview was teleological. By teleological, I mean that there was an end towards which all natural processes, living processes, all things were aimed towards some goal, some end. We're supposed to achieve this end. And so whether it be in physics, you have four elements like earth, air, water, fire. And those four elements all have a natural tendency to go in a particular direction. That's their end. Earth, the end, the goal of earth, of material stuff, is to go towards the center. Fire's end is to go away from the center. Those sorts of things like that. In biology, the end of any particular creature is to grow to be a complete and total creature in according to the way it was supposed to be, according to its form. In astronomy, a part of the worldview is that there is sort of this picture with the Earth in the center of the universe, and everything in the universe is according to the way it's supposed to be. It goes according to the way it's supposed to be. The planets and the stars go around the Earth because that's their natural motion. So you have a very coherent, complete picture, very teleological, very ends-oriented. Even Aristotle's Ethics is fitting in that kind of a perspective, that what is the goal of man is the end of man. Ethics is the end, is to figure out what is the end of man. So this is the medieval period. As time went on, there came a number of criticisms, and the criticisms came from all kinds of different areas, science being one of the main areas that the criticism came. And the first place I think it came from was in astronomy. Astronomy seems to be sort of the central area where this whole criticism of the medieval worldview came to a head. And the person who sort of launched everything off was Copernicus. He was asked, this is around 1540, he was asked to study the calendar by the church because people didn't know exactly how long a year was. And as a consequence, the seasons and the months got off. You know, you would have July and it wasn't hot anymore or something. I don't know exactly which direction it was, but the seasons and the months got off because the day was wrong and had been, you know, lots and lots of years where they've been off a little bit, and so the seasons were off. So they were trying to figure out how long is a year. So Copernicus goes back and he's studying the information and the knowledge that was available then. He starts studying a variety of different ancient authors, and he discovers that not all the authors agreed with Ptolemy. Ptolemy was sort of the person who had taken Aristotelian cosmology with the Earth in the center and perfected it in order to be able to calculate exactly where all the planets were supposed to be. So Ptolemy has this big picture. He can calculate where the planets, where the stars, the sun, all that kind of stuff. We can calculate exactly where everything goes with the Earth being in the center. And Copernicus noticed that some people disagreed with Ptolemy and said that the sun was actually in the center of the solar system instead of the Earth. So he got to thinking about that, and he concluded in the end that that was in fact right. Now, the thing that is interesting for us, I think, is the rationale for why he believed that was the case. It was not the case that Copernicus had new data. It was not the case that Copernicus used new mathematics. He used all the same evidence and the same data tables that everybody else was using, and he used the same mathematical schemes. He used epicycles, exactly the same way Ptolemy. Ptolemy had these circles where the planets were on these circles which were going around bigger circles, and they had this swirling pattern as the planet would go around the Earth. Copernicus used the same kinds of mathematical techniques. What he was convinced of, though, was that the whole system as a whole, the planetary system as a whole, just made sense, was more coherent, was more rational, was more beautiful, was more orderly than the Ptolemaic system. The Ptolemaic system was disjointed. None of the planets had any impact on any of the other planets. They were taken as separate calculations, separate systems. They overlapped each other. It was hard to see how everything should fit together. And there were some problems with it and that sort of thing. Copernicus thought that if you just put the sun in the center, it sort of makes everything more, it fits better together. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that. I mean, you'd have to look at what Copernicus actually said to go into the details. But the main point is that things fit together. And he, being someone who believed in God, expected that the Earth, or that the solar system, or the universe, or whatever you wanted to call it at that time, ought to display the order and the rationality of a creator. And so because of his assumption, his presupposition that the creator would create an orderly pattern, he was convinced that his system was true. And this idea that we are looking for orderly patterns in the universe as a key feature of science is really important, and we'll see that pop up over and over in the history of science over and over again. Now, there were other beliefs besides Copernicus at that time. In fact, Ptolemy's idea of the planets going around was just one system. There were multiple different systems, all of which more or less had the Earth in the center, but they had different specific calculations for how things went. In fact, there was one person that said the Earth was in the center, and the sun goes around the Earth, and then the planets all go around the sun. A guy named Tycho Brahe. So there's a variety of different systems. So the standard technique to say at that time was to say, well, astronomy cannot really tell us the true motions of the heavens. The only thing that can, all we can do is we can do calculations of the motions of the heavens, and we can try to predict where they're going to be, but astronomy can't actually tell us where the heaven, where the stars and the planets and stuff are going to exactly be, where they actually are. And obviously Copernicus did not believe this. But the church took this as a position, and this becomes particularly important when we move on to the next sort of phase in the whole system, which was when Galileo came along. Okay, and At that time, the church said to Galileo, you may go ahead and teach Copernican revolution, or not the Copernican revolution, but the Copernican theory, if you teach it as if it were simply another calculational model and not the true model. Okay? Galileo, however, I think, was convinced that the sun was actually in the center of the solar system, but he had to tread lightly given this requirement. In fact, the Pope or the church told him, go ahead and teach the Copernican revolution or the Copernican theory, but not as a true theory. He had gotten that spot already because he had ticked off all of the scientists and the teachers and the scholars in all the universities in Italy by having these public debates. They would have these public debates. It was very common. And it was very important for their career to, you know, win these debates and all this other stuff like this. And they would have these public debates, and Galileo would bring up some idea that they had about Aristotle's physics, and then he would do some demonstration which made it look really ludicrous. And for some reason, that really made all of his peers angry at him. And they were the ones that lobbied strongly with the church for and with a variety of religious teachers at the time to use the church as a way to censure Galileo, because he was making them he was embarrassing them, I think, was part of it. And Galileo was kind of obnoxious. I mean, you have to admit, he had his obnoxious side. So he got into this trouble, but his main thing that he was doing when he was writing his book was showing that sort of the Aristotelian worldview, the whole perspective, the philosophical undergirdings, the physical ideas that he had put in place, the cosmological ideas, everything that was no longer valid, that there are other ways of thinking about things besides just the way that Aristotle had thought about things. The church had sort of assumed that Aristotle and the biblical understanding of the Bible were sort of one and the same, and the two of them fit together to some extent. And so they had adopted some of the Aristotelian ideas into their interpretation of the Bible. And Galileo wanted to say, no, that's not exactly right. It doesn't make sense. It's not rational. It's not coherent. It doesn't fit together. The same kind of arguments that that Copernicus used. Some of the things that we want to pull out from the lessons of Galileo and Copernicus is that we are starting to get a rejection of the old authorities, the authority of Aristotle. And in some sense, it's just beginning to question even the authority of the Bible and how are we to understand, and especially the authority of the church fathers and the way that they're interpreting the Bible and those sorts of things. We'll read a little bit about that when we read the Galileo reading, that sort of thing. But slowly but surely, we're rejecting the old authorities and we're saying we as men, humans, can figure out exactly what is true and what is not true on our own, using our own reason and our own rationality and that sort of thing like that. So, among the other things that was largely rejected in this time was the teleological aspects of Aristotle. And in place of the teleological aspects, a lot of the Renaissance and Enlightenment thinkers, Enlightenment is just sort of the period where people start believing that we can figure stuff out using science and figuring things, what's true and what's not true, on our own. A lot of the thinkers started taking on what I would call mechanism, a mechanistic perspective, in replacing the teleological perspective. We're taking a mechanistic perspective. Things are just atoms in the void that are moving around and bumping into each other and hitting each other, and the results that we see are the results of those mechanical forces and mechanical actions and mechanical bumpings and pushings and things like that. One of the main promoters of this particular perspective was Descartes. Descartes introduced sort of a dualism where you have the mechanical world on the one hand, which is subject only to these natural principles and things bumping into each other, as compared to more of a mind, spiritual, God level, which is separate from the mechanical, physical realm. So he wanted to separate these sorts of things. And he started to ask himself, using some of these assumptions that he has adopted from his culture or he's come up with on his own, he started to ask himself, if we no longer have the old authors, the old authorities to tell us what's true and what's not true, how are we going to figure out what's true and what's not true? He likes Aristotle's idea of science. Remember what science was? Demonstration? You start with these premises and you build deductively from the premises. So he likes that. But he asks himself, what are the first premises? Where are we going to start? What are we going to find that's truly true and is not subject to doubt? And that's where we get the famous, I think, therefore I am, he says. I'm thinking about, you know, whether I exist. But if I'm thinking about whether I exist, I'm at least thinking. So I'm doing something, so I can't not exist. So because I'm thinking, I exist. Or something to that effect. I'm sure the philosophers in the room could give you a better description of what's going on there. But basically, his key idea is that we've got to find those premises that start, that are unassailable, that are certain. What we're looking for is certainty, 100% certainty, that cannot be regarded as untrue. They're necessary. In addition to Descartes, there was sort of another school. Descartes is one of these guys that says the way we're going to find those first premises or the first principles is by using our mind. Our mind is able and capable of coming up with first principles, and just by thinking we can come up with exactly those things that are true. There was another school of thought at that same time that said the first principles are principles that we get, or the evidences that we get from our senses. Our senses are reliable, okay? We see things, we feel things, we touch things. That stuff is telling us what's true. And that is reliable, and that's true. And this is sort of along the more empiricist school. So you have Descartes is representative of the rationalist school, where we can use our minds to figure out what those principles are, first principles. And the empiricist school says the senses are the things which are trustworthy and that cannot be denied, okay? Somebody like John Locke, who resurrects the tabula rasa, that says our mind is this blank slate and the evidences of our senses from when we're born or come in and they fill up that slate. And that is what forms who we are, our character, our personality, everything about us, our knowledge, all comes from those. We just have this, you know, it's like an empty computer or something like that, and it just, the stuff just comes in, and then we form who we are from that. So again, the issue is, where are those, what are the things that are trustworthy, the first principles that we can rely on, that sort of thing. Now, following Descartes, following the empiricists, I should say, one of the primary empiricists that made a big splash in the scientific community was Isaac Newton. He's writing a little before 1700 and through the beginning of the early 1700s. What Newton says, okay, is induction from experience is a reasonable starting point. What do I mean by induction? Induction simply means that we observe, in this case, we observe something to be true. In this case, it's true. In this case, it's true. In all these cases, all these similar cases, it seems to be true. Therefore, we can conclude universally that it's going to be true in every case. I drop my pen today, I drop my pen tomorrow, I can conclude, and it always falls to the floor. It falls to the floor when I drop it in Paris, it falls to the floor when I drop it in Brazil. We're going to conclude that wherever I am on the earth, whatever day it is, if I drop my pen, it's going to fall to the floor. This is sort of induction, okay? Newton says, yay for induction. This works. In fact, he says, if you don't do induction, basically you can't do science, which I tend to agree with him, okay? If you can't draw universal principles from particular experiences, you can't even do any science. You're sort of stuck in a rut. So science, Newton uses his inductive method, And he introduces new mathematical techniques at the same time. And he is able to come to some rather far-reaching and startling theories that make sense of a huge variety of different phenomena that had been confusing and unexplained and hard to figure out from the beginning of time. He, using his universal theory of gravity, is able to explain the motions of the planets. He is able to explain the tides. He's able to explain the motion of the moon and the wobbles in the moon. It's just phenomenal, the number of different, that he's able to explain the shape of the Earth as not being perfectly spherical. And he also comes up with theories of motion and how things move and the kinds of laws that we have with regard to motion. It was a big hit. It worked really well. People responded to Newton's science by saying, yes, this is the way it can be done, and we are going to have success with this, and this is the right way of doing things. And we finally have a way of gaining knowledge, and it is legitimate. I would say Newton sort of is, although there were precursors, Newton sort of epitomizes the emergence of modern science. There is modern science in a nutshell. We use the experiences that we have, we induce principles, we draw conclusions from those, and we test it with new experiments or new observations to find out whether the principles that we have induced are actually correct. And that seemed to be a fairly successful method, technique. All right. There were, however, detractors. Okay? People like David Hume. Okay? He recognized, as many others did, along with Descartes, because remember, Descartes was interested in finding first principles from our mind, not from the evidence of our senses, specifically. And Hume recognized that the evidence of our senses can be deceived. The primary major example of this is that we all feel like we're not moving. At least we should say we don't feel like we're moving at 37,000 miles an hour. I mean, would everybody agree? The evidence of our senses tells us that we're sitting still on the earth and we're not going anywhere. Our rationality and other evidences have led us to the conclusion that in fact we are rotating and moving around the sun at 37,000 miles an hour, or something like that. Pretty fast. So this is the prime example that the evidence of our senses are not necessarily reliable. And Hume took it to the extreme. He says, how do we know that our experience is correct? Remember the question? How do we know that our first principles are unassailable, exactly right, perfect, certain? And he says, we don't. We don't know that for certain. So ultimately where Hume goes is he says, all we have is these impressions that come into our mind. And we have the internal workings of our mind, and we have the experiences of the ideas that we have in our mind, and that's the only thing that we know for certain. Okay? So really, we have empiricism in its most radical form. All we have is sense experience, which comes into our mind, and the only thing that we can say is that the impressions that we have in our mind, we can talk about those as being true or not true. But whether that actually corresponds to a reality out there, which is the same way that we experience it through our senses, is not certain. We can't say that's for sure. Okay? And so we've retreated as to what is certain in a really, really radical way, according to Hume. Okay? So he has sort of provided the seed, I would say, of the demise of our notion of what is true and what is not true in our modern world, I would say. That there's a lot of stuff that we can't really know. And he's going to come up again later. So after Hume is around 1750, during this time, after Newton, during the 1800s, science in general is a working out of the Newtonian world. They use induction. They come to conclusions, and this technique is remarkably successful, fantastically successful. They are able to understand phenomenon and things that happen that nobody ever had any inkling of how to understand that stuff. They understand gases. They can understand the motions of fluids and how they work. They can understand heat and how it moves around and what's going on in those situations like that. They can understand mechanical things in a way that nobody had ever been able to calculate or understand before using sort of the Newtonian perspective. And they're applying new mathematical techniques to all these sorts of things, and it's just blossoming in all kinds of different directions in a successful way. And as a consequence of that, people start to think, even in Newton's time, although Newton disagreed vehemently with this perspective, people started believing that there were these natural laws, like the law of gravity, for instance. And these natural laws were sort of put into place from the very beginning by God, and then hands off, the clockwork universe. Okay? So it's just a clock ticking along, and God doesn't have anything to do with it. And this becomes a very popular perspective. So we have this rise and growing perspective of naturalism. I would call that naturalism, that it's just natural forces that are actually occurring. We have the success of science because of the technological growth. I mean, they could make cannons and guns, and they could make, you know, steam engines eventually, and, you know, just all kinds of, eventually electricity, light bulbs, all that kind of good stuff. Okay. So naturalism starts becoming more and more important, and sort of the capstone in the naturalistic perspective was when Charles Darwin came along and he says, look, not only are physics naturalistic, but biology is naturalistic too. That we can explain the emergence of life through purely naturalistic processes and stuff like that. So there's a growing belief that science and naturalism are the way to go. And as a response to that, there is a growing desire to reject any kind of metaphysics. Okay, metaphysics is the study of things which are not physical. Okay, the primary thing, the primary metaphysical object that people were trying to reject, in my opinion, is God. They didn't want to have to deal with God. God is metaphysical. And by saying that all there is natural stuff, we can reject God in a fairly convenient fashion. Okay? One of the schools that arose that was one of the leaders in rejecting metaphysics is what's called logical positivism. This is around 1880, I think, somewhere in that general area, maybe off back 20 years or something. So logical positivism, the sort of the poster boy for logical positivism is Ernst Mach. Okay? And he says, okay, that only empirical evidence is legitimate. Okay, and he even goes so far as to say, you know, guys, when we come up with equations that describe phenomenon and stuff like that, he says, those equations don't point to any reality behind the scenes. Those equations are simply ways that we can economically take into consideration all the data that we have observed. He writes this paper called The Economy of Science. And he says that all equations and mathematics and all that kind of stuff like that, it's just a way of making it easier for ourselves to categorize and to take into consideration all of the phenomenon and the empirical evidence. Because after all, empirical evidence is the only thing which is real and true. So this, it seems to me, is a rejection of sort of the Copernicus-Galileo approach, which says what science is looking for is order, is looking for the underlying reality behind the evidences that we see, the experiences that we have. Okay? So it is it is going totally 180 degrees opposite of the way people in, say, the early Renaissance and stuff were thinking about in terms of looking for the orderly creation that God has created for us. There is no underlying truth or rational coherence. Now, logical positivism worked its way out in a variety of different areas. When is this over? Okay, I gotta hurry up. Logical positivism worked itself out. I'm sort of skip over, but basically, quantum mechanics is strongly dependent on logical positivism. A lot of the biology, for instance, to say that there is some underlying meaningful distinction between different kinds of creatures is not the way the biologists thought about it. All we have is just the evidence of all these various different creatures. They're all evolved one from another, and they're all sort of just in this continuum. And so all we're doing is we're categorizing things to make it convenient for us to talk about them. There's nothing really fundamental underlying distinction between these kinds of creatures. So that would be another example of what's going on there. Nevertheless, people had sort of a positive outlook. That's why they call it logical positivism, that science was going to, using this logical positivism, that we were going to be able to solve a lot of the ills of society. Our math and science was going to branch out in other fields, and we're going to get rid of all these metaphysical fields. Religion and all these sorts of things like that. We're going to get rid of all that stuff and we're going to advance and things are going to be a brave new world or something. So, modernism is this idea that, science is the only legitimate knowledge. It talks about empirical evidence. And that particular view has been passed down through since that time to a lot of the way scientists think about things now. That's not the only way that people think about things now, too, because since that time there have been critiques of sort of the modernist or logical positivist perspective. Okay? Those aren't necessarily exactly the same thing. But the critiques are what I would call postmodern critiques, okay? Where we ask ourselves, is it possible to come to any real ultimate truth, or are all truths in some sense relative? One of the critiques came from a fellow named Popper, okay? And his view is the one that often is taught in schools nowadays, and he says, basically, how you do science is you have a hypothesis. And then you go about and you test that hypothesis to find out whether it's correct or not. And you make a prediction. And you do an experiment. If the experiment agrees with the prediction, then you have a greater confidence that your hypothesis is correct. But you don't know with 100% certainty that it's correct. You just have a greater confidence. Whereas if the experiment disagrees with the prediction, then you know your hypothesis is wrong. And so this is what he called falsification, that all we can do is falsify hypotheses, but we can't know for certain that they are true. Well, this is sort of in tension, it seems to me, with sort of the modernist perspective that says that scientists can know exactly what's true, we can figure out what is right, what is wrong, and that science somehow has the only way of figuring out what is right and what is wrong. Again, it's that same question that has come up. Can we know with 100% certainty of what is right and what is not right? And he's saying, well, not really. All you can have is greater confidence that something is right or not right. Another criticism of sort of the modern view came through a fellow named Wittgenstein, who was a philosopher who claimed, I think, if I got him right, that basically language and culture are determinative of how we view the world and what we believe is to be true. So different cultures have different languages, They have different ways of talking about things, different modes of operating in their intellectual life. And they will come to different conclusions. And there is no way of determining which culture and language is the right culture and language. It's all just the happenstance of where you happen to be born as to what you believe. Okay? So this is a radically relative kind of perspective about knowledge. There is no objective truth. The philosopher or scientist of science who adopts Wittgenstein is Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn says that scientists have their own language and culture. Everybody has what he called a paradigm that they work in. We use a certain kinds of equations. We use certain kinds of examples. We use certain kinds of experiments. Everybody learns the same sort of canon of what's true and what's not true. And we work within that language, within that culture, and that sort of thing like that. Occasionally, he suggested that that particular perspective could be radically altered according to a paradigm shift, he called it, where you adopt a new kind of language, a new set of examples that everybody works out, a new set of a way of thinking about things. So again, you can see how that's related. You have this one paradigm, you have an older paradigm, you have a new paradigm. The new paradigm doesn't necessarily have to answer exactly all the problems of the old paradigm. It's just that you have to have a community which is shifting their focus from the old way of looking at things to the new way of looking at things. And so what is true and what is not true is determined by what that community believes in general. Okay? And so if you want to have people believe what you believe, you need to convince the community that it's true. And so you have to use the right language and the right evidences and all that other kind of stuff like that. Kuhn says that that doesn't mean that you can't come to closer and closer knowledge of the truth, but I don't see how that's consistent with his perspective. It seems to me that it is a pretty radically relative kind of view of what knowledge is all about, scientific knowledge. So it seems to me that today's current situation is sort of an amalgam of the modernist and postmodern perspectives. On the one hand, science has been successful. It has been technologically successful. The method of Newton has done wonders for our understanding of the natural world. Darwin has even introduced a number of interesting ways of thinking about things, and has discovered and made some valid critiques of the way people were thinking about things in the past. So on the one hand, we've got the rational, scientific, empirical stream of ideas which are coming to us from that sort of modernistic view. At the same, and they want to, you know, reject the metaphysical. On the other hand, you've got these critiques, okay, through the postmodern perspective, which is providing a certain amount of tension for that view. The scientists, it seems like, recognize that when they're debating among themselves, that there is a lot of give and take and a lot of uncertainty and all that sort of thing. But they present a pretty solid front to the public, because there is a certain amount of authority that they hold as scientists in our society. And they are reluctant to give up that authority. I would say that slowly but surely our culture, it seems to me that our culture is starting to respond and reject in some sense that anti-metaphysical outlook, that spiritualism is sort of on the uprise in our day and age, that people are, if you go out to, well, maybe this is not a good sampling of the nation, but if you go, for instance, to Eugene and talk to people in Eugene, there is a lot of, there's some higher being. I don't know exactly what it is, and I can't tell you anything about it, but there is some higher being. I know in my gut that that is the case. Okay? that's becoming more and more pervasive. So there is some sort of, well, science doesn't have all the answers. But at the same time, they hold on to the same, in the next breath, they'll say, well, if the physicists say it's true or the biologists say it's true, it must be true. So that, it seems to me, is where things stand today. And that's about all I have to say.
Who would like to be first? Questions?
I was thinking about when Chris was talking about Poplar and the idea in science of falsification, that we will hold something to be, well, true, and but we always have to know there's something that come up and make it wrong, right? So we can never be positive. So I was just thinking about the way that we hold truth in Scripture. When we come to an understanding, we come to it always thinking, well, we might be proven wrong about that interpretation. Could you talk to that, Jack? Or, I mean, is that, are there likenesses there between the two? Or
there are. Correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different view of this, but the difference between the ancients and the moderns in when it comes to knowledge is the, in the ancient world, and I would argue this is commonsensical. I mean, I think this is true of modern people when they're not doing epistemology too, when they're just out living their life. We have this sense that there's a world out there that can be known, and I am so equipped that I am able to know it. And I kind of know when I know. That's the basic underlying confidence and optimism of the ancients. Someone like Aristotle, for example. There's this fit between my mind and the world, and when I see the fit between my mind and my knowledge in the world, then I know that I know. So Aristotle, I think, would have a real problem with Popper. I mean, to say, well, I'm more certain, but I don't know yet. You know, I think Aristotle would say, well, get a life then. I mean, come on. Join the human race. We're made to know. Whereas Popper is on the other end of this revolution in epistemology that tried to take the humanity out of knowledge. It's not human beings that know, it's methods that get us to truth. And so his problem is, well, on this method, where the only way you could have certainty is if you could, is if the method could rule out any possible exception, you could never have certainty because the method can't rule out an exception. So he's trying to, that's what happened during the Enlightenment, is we tried to mechanize knowledge. We use the mechanical metaphor for knowledge. Whereas everyone before that assumed that human beings were the people who were in the process of coming to knowledge, and human beings were intelligent. Sorry. You want a better answer, don't you? I'm done. I'll just add, it's really interesting to read people like Hume, Locke, even a lot of these philosophers who are right on the cutting edge of mechanizing knowledge. The only way they can make the machinery of their mind work is if you imagine little people inside there making judgments. And they talk about these transactions coming to some conclusion or making some inference or something. The way we all know that inferences are made as human beings, but they just stick it inside the machinery of our mind. And it becomes plausible, but the only reason it becomes plausible is because it's no longer a machine. It's a little gremlin in there who's making it work. So you can't really ultimately mechanize knowledge. Even a computer can do that, but only because we've mapped our own mind onto the machinery of the computer, not because it can do that on its own.
Chris or Jack, what with the direction that our culture is headed and the science world is headed, how is it affecting, let's say, research of disease or whatever? How is that important? What is the connection?
I'm not exactly sure what your question is. How does sort of the modern view of science affect medical research? Is that what you're asking?
For example. does it make a difference, or?
Well, you think, can I make a couple of comments?
Go ahead.
In fact, Tom, maybe you want to comment. Tom was saying some interesting stuff in our session about, from your perspective, Darwinistic evolutionary theory, for example. Your professor was saying to you that he knows of no real insights into nature that has happened because it's been stimulated by the evolutionary worldview. Is that right? Which is actually very contrary to what you often hear in the debate, that the evolutionists are often saying, this is so productive. I mean, science is going to cease to be productive if we get rid of this paradigm because this is what's driving all the research. But that doesn't make any sense to me. And that was interesting that your professor would say that. The other thing that I might comment in medical research is this mechanization that we're talking about has reduced us and our brains to machines. So there's this propensity to go to find a drug to solve all of our problems because every problem is just the chemistry of the body. If we're just a machine, that's a plausible thing. But if we're actually human beings, then we're more complex than that, and other kinds of answers would make sense if we're human beings.
I would also add that, I mean, there is a sense in which there is a community of researchers in the medical community, and whether or not a particular perspective, namely whether we're machines or not, or whether or not a particular research should be done, is highly dependent on that community and how they convince each other and the politics and the fighting and all that other stuff that happens within that. So there is a sense in which Kuhn is right in describing some of the phenomena that happens that's going on right there. And they all have a behind-the-scenes philosophical perspective as to what's true and what's not true, and that does influence the kinds of answers that they could give.
Can I get a quick clarification from you, Chris? You were in your lecture, which was great, by the way. You associated, as I'm trying to remember, if you associated the notion of the sort of mechanist view of reality and the cosmos with Newton? Yes,
well,
or no?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a connection there that with the introduction of these natural laws and mechanical laws, that enhanced or encouraged sort of the mechanistic perspective.
Okay.
Now, Newton himself was not a hard-going mechanist. And one of the evidences of that was that a lot of people criticized Newton's theory of gravity for being a cult being hidden properties, that there was this hidden tendencies like Earth has a tendency to go towards the center or something like that. They would call that an occult property, and they would say, how is it that some body way off in a distance can be attracted to some other body over here? Okay? And Newton's response was, well, the evidence suggests that that's in fact what's going on. I don't know what the cause is for that. I'm not going to, he says famous words, feign a hypothesis as to why that's going on. But nevertheless, the evidence and the experiences that we have and the theory and everything all fits together to show us that is, in fact, what's happening. So it's not a cult. It's determined by our experiences and our
evidence. So then how would you describe or characterize, if we slid into sort of a mechanist model at that point, how would you just characterize broadly and generally what preceded that?
Well, I think Newton was in the midst of a mechanistic revolution.
Okay.
That Descartes was already a mechanist. He had the heavens were filled with this fluid of little tiny particles, because the only way that the heavens could move would be if there was something that was bumping or pushing, or the planets were in this big swirl of stuff that was going around, and everything was bumping and shoving against each other. Galileo was really a pretty much a hardcore mechanist too, I would say. In fact, his contemporary, Johannes Kepler, said that the reason why the tides are the way they are is because of the influence of the moon. Galileo says, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not mechanistic. How could something way up there have an influence on the moon? That sounds
like astrology, like occult, like all that other stuff like that. So Galileo came up with this weird, extravagant explanation for the tides having to do with sloshing of the earth and the distance between the one side of the sea and the other side of the sea. It was just bogus. But he wouldn't believe in Kepler. Kepler had going for him this incredible correlation that the moon is related to the tides and has been from day one forever. I mean, it's just a fantastic correlation. How could you not agree with that? But it's not mechanistic, so he denied it.
Just one further question, and that is, if it became increasingly mechanistic, what word would your adjective would you use to describe what preceded that? We went from X to mechanistic.
Well, I think teleological. I don't know. That would be my. Would you say that, Charlie?
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, I would agree with you, Chris. I think that's right, that it was teleological, that Aristotle's view was held first. But the only thing I was going to interject is you look at Copernicus. I mean, in some way, you can look at Copernicus as having a mechanistic view of sort. I mean, he talks about the whole universe being a clockwork of God. I mean, that's their vision. It's organized. All the parts fit together in a rational, organized manner. Well, that's one sense of mechanism. What's shifting here is now, what it's shifting away from, as Chris pointed out, is mechanism moves from God sort of artistically building this really organized, interrelated, with all these interrelated parts structure, down to now it's just atoms colliding. That the concept of mechanism itself undergoes that evolution. And in the place that where it started, I think key points in that evolution were the people you highlighted, Descartes, Hume. So anyway, it's in a theistic view, you do look at it as a mechanism. I mean, it's organized, it's rational, all of the parts fit. So in a sense, that is mechanical of sorts. So anyway, I think that
in the Dover School Board, Judge Jones, blah blah blah, he really seems to be attacking intelligent design theory for a lot of holes. How there was stuff in the Pandas and People, whatever book, that had been since shown to be not true, and how Behe's argument had these faults in it about irreducible complexity, about the blood clotting cascade and that sort of thing. What, in your minds, like, what needs to, not that intelligent design is ever going to be considered as respectable in the scientific community, but what needs to happen in the intelligent design movement for these sort of embarrassing lapses to, like, not be there anymore? Like, what would be, in your minds, some sort of good evidence, I guess, that the theory made some level of sense?
It's not clear to me that there are any embarrassing lapses, but that Judge Jones portrayed them as mm-hmm. embarrassing lapses. So I would say the only way that you're not going to get embarrassing lapses is if people change their worldview. And I don't see that happening any time in the near future, at least not on a broad scale.
I guess, like, things being, what sort of, perhaps the question I meant to ask was, what sort of things in other things do you see that could be put forth in support of intelligent design? Like, they put forth this irreducible complexity argument for certain things, and then it was shown that for the blood clotting cascade, for example, that it does work if you take out a couple pieces. So what are some other things do you think that could be used as evidence of irreducible complexity?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe somebody who's studied this a little bit more than me would know better. But my guess is that they've just misrepresented Behe's argument
and just sort of disregarded the thrust of what it is that he's saying, and that their argument that says that the blood clotting doesn't work or is not a valid argument is not necessarily. I mean, you have to look at both sides of the issue, and that's the thing about this particular Judge Jones's verdict, is that he's not giving you really a sympathetic reading of Behe. And so I think a sympathetic reading of Behe doesn't necessarily have those problems in it. So it's not like Behe is tried and the intelligence design community is tried and, wow, the scientific community really put him back. They didn't, I don't think. I mean, I don't know, maybe some other people have read a little bit more on that issue and could address that more directly.
Jack, could you, in our discussion, Jack pointed out that perhaps the ID people are kind of making, they're sort of misangling their argument. Could you rearticulate that? That helps, I think, with this.
Go ahead, because I'm not sure.
Well, the question was, you were talking about how the argument is about design, not about origins.
Oh, okay, right. I'm not sure, and again, it's hard to know how much Judge Jones is misrepresenting it and to what extent the case for IDEA in that courtroom, at least, was misrepresenting the argument. But I would argue that the argument between evolutionary theory and intelligent design are not competing theories of origin. Intelligent design is not a theory of origin. It's something else entirely different. What I would argue is that, because you see it in Aristotle and for hundreds and hundreds of years of human history, people have just taken for granted that human organisms are designed. That's commonplace. Well, I would argue that that's a prima facie correct and valid and warranted conclusion. You see something that looks designed, you conclude that it's designed. And the only reason you wouldn't attribute design to it would be if someone can give you some explanation for how it looks designed without being designed. Well, the power of Darwin in culture and in intellectual history is that was on the surface a possible explanation of how something could look designed without being designed. Is that his argument was, well, just the physics and biology of this is such that you can get this increasing complexity in organization just randomly, just through the random processes of life. There wasn't any designer here. Well, if that's valid, if that's the case, then the prima facie fact that something looks designed is no longer a reason to believe that it's designed. So that's a very powerful objection to intelligent design then. But what that means is, Judge Jones presented it as this false dichotomy. Either evolution is true or idea is true, and the logic of the idea position is we can prove evolution doesn't work, therefore idea is right. Well, I don't know any ID person who would characterize the logic of their argument that way. I mean, I maybe there are some, but I have never read them that way. My perspective is always that we have a prima facie warrant for believing that biological organisms are designed. That's prima facie true. Now, could I be wrong about that? Evolution says, yes, you're wrong about that. Look, here's how it could happen without it being designed. Behe goes and looks at it and says, okay, do they have an explanation for how we can get from point A here to point B here without it being designed? I don't see a plausible, adequate explanation there. Judge Jones calls that a negative argument. Well, yes, it's a negative argument, because he has a fallback prima facie position that most of mankind throughout most of history has thought was entirely intelligent, entirely warranted to believe in that. All you need is a negative argument. If prima facie, you already have the conclusion of design making sense, being rationally warranted. So, the other thing that drives me crazy, I saw a debate between Miller, who is one of the expert witnesses in the case, and somebody from the Discovery Institute, and he brought up the bacteria flagellum and argues that, well, look, there are people who have proposed that the flagellum could be this mechanism, the type 2 secretor, and this other mechanism in combination with one another. Okay, that's fine. But notice that you not in the decision, and I dare say I'll bet you not in his expert testimony, although I don't know that for sure, certainly not in this debate that I heard. In this debate that I heard, his explanation for how the flagellum comes into being is you've got this mechanism that had this other function in this organism, and you have this mechanism that has this other function in this organism, and somehow they got combined and into the bacteria flagellum. Well, it's that somehow that is the crux of the issue. I mean, what Behe and ID people are saying is, show me how natural selection can explain the somehow, and now you got me. But if you can't explain the somehow through mutation, natural selection, and these other biological processes, then it looks designed to me, and I don't see any reason why I shouldn't call it design. Because you have not given me an alternative.
Evolutionary people are so strong in their position and so confident of their position, all they really need to offer is plausibility arguments for their own particular position. And that is strong enough evidence for their position. Therefore, it's true. We have a plausibility argument as to how this could happen, and therefore it did.
I think, Dave, you were suggesting in our group that it's kind of what Chris was saying, is we now have been so acculturated to believe in evolution that it's almost like that's the prima facie warranted position rather than the other.
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.